Ben Smith, I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening. Hello people, Ben here, hope you're good, I hope you're hanging in there at least. I was going to go into a massive rant about the dual global clusterfucks that are Donald Trump and Brexit, but I can't face it to be honest. Well, it's supposed to be a photography podcast, what am I going to say that you don't already know? If you are listening in the United States, welcome along, and just know that we know how utterly embarrassed you must feel, but your embarrassment will be a dim and distant memory before long, whereas ours will last for many, many decades to come. This is episode 90 of my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Welcome along. Many thanks for joining me as always. This week, I am happy to say that my guest is a British documentary photographer and member of the Noor Photo Agency, Alexandra Fazina. Let's do the usual housekeeping and a message from your sponsor before I introduce Alexandra properly. If you enjoy the podcast, you think it's worth the price of a cup of coffee per episode, then please do sign up for a small recurring monthly subscription, or if you prefer, make a larger occasional donation at bensmithphoto.com/a small voice. Do please leave a positive review on iTunes so that others may find out about it. And if it's high time you had a new and improved website on which to showcase your work, because your current one isn't really up to this job, I will happily do the whole thing using the Squarespace platform for a very competitive rate. I want to again let you all know that your sponsor for this episode, the wonderful Charcot Book Club, the world's first Book of the Month club dedicated exclusively to photo books, have announced that the annual Chico Hot Springs Portfolio Review and Charcoal Publishing Prize is open for entries from now until the 10th of December. You can submit now by going to charcoalbookclub.com and clicking on Portfolio Review in the top left corner. Now, this is the third year Charcoal have run this event, which will take place at the end of March 2019. The Chico Review is a juried photo book retreat that takes place over 6 nights at Chico Hot Springs Resort near Livingston in Montana. 45 photographers will be selected by the jury and invited to spend the week taking part in portfolio reviews, artist lectures, panel discussions, and getting together over drinks in the salon and the hot springs, which I am personally looking forward to, because yeah, I am going to be there. The all-star panel of speakers and reviewers will include Todd Heido, Mark Steinmetz, Andrea Modica, Alex Webb, Rebecca Norris-Webb, Aperture, Pier 24 Photography, Chose Commune, TBW Books, and many others. Not only is this a rare chance to showcase your projects and workshop ideas with some of the best in the business, but one grand prize winner will receive the coveted Charcoal Publishing Prize, which means one lucky photographer will earn the right to be published and distributed worldwide by Charcoal Book Club. So it does look like it's going to be awesome. The venue looks like it's going to be awesome. Happily, I will be there, as I say, as an invited media partner. I'll be hosting a couple of panels, talking to as many people as possible, maybe looking at some work, which will be fun, and hopefully getting some podcast chats in the can with some of those people who I have just mentioned. So it's going to be great. Submit now by going to charcoalbookclub.com and click on Portfolio Review in the top left corner. While you're there, check out this month's Book of the Month, which is Half Story, Half Life by Raymond Meeks. That one was curated by Ron Jude. Some of you will know of those people. If you love photo books, join the club. Use the code ASMALLVOICE to claim a free book of your choice when you do join. So Alexandra Fazina, whose photography focuses on underreported conflicts and the often overlooked humanitarian consequences of war, has an uncanny ability to gain access to and work in the most challenging circumstances imaginable, and is recognised for her compassionate and empathetic approach. She was born in East London, where she is now based, but spent much of her childhood in the Netherlands because of her father's work. She studied fine art at the University of Bristol, and in 1995, the day after she finished her course, she went to Bosnia with the British Armed Forces as an official war artist, and it was there that she developed her interest in photography. Since then, she has worked independently as a photojournalist throughout Eastern Europe, Africa, the Middle East and Asia. Her stories have been widely published in the British and international press, and her photographs exhibited worldwide. In 2008, after working on assignment in Afghanistan, she moved to Pakistan, where she lived for 6 years. During that time, over a two-year period, she worked to chronicle the exodus of migrants and refugees from Somalia across the Gulf of Aden to the Arabian Peninsula. The resulting book, A Million Shillings, Escape from Somalia, was published by Trolley Books in 2010. A Million Shillings, the title of which comes from the fare paid by refugees to the traffickers, about £50 sterling, was shortlisted for the Pictures of the Year International Best Photography Book of the Year Award. A selection of the works was also shortlisted for the Prix Pictet Global Award in Photography and Sustainability. In 2008, she was a recipient of the Vic Odden Award from the British Royal Photographic Society for her work in Somalia, and was a finalist in the Care Award for Humanitarian Reportage and the W. Eugene Smith Grant in Humanistic Photography. In 2010, Alexandra won the highly prestigious UNHCR Nansen Refugee Award for her striking coverage of the devastating human consequences of war and her fearless and tireless dedication to humanitarian photography throughout her career. Having spent 6 years documenting the effects of conflict and displacement in Afghanistan and Pakistan, she produced the long-term project The Flowers of Afghanistan, documenting the stories of Afghan children seeking refuge in Europe. The photographic investigation looks into the causes and effects of the increasing number of Afghan minors making the hazardous overland journey to apply for asylum in EU member states. In addition to her photography and writing, Alexandra has worked as a researcher and producer for broadcast media and is a regular contributor for radio, and she regularly teaches masterclasses and workshops around the world for organisations such as World Press Photo, Reporters Without Borders and the Royal Photographic Society. She lectures in art, photography and media at photography and literature festivals and on under- and postgraduate programmes at universities. She's also a member of the NOR Collective. So as you can probably tell from that intro, Alexandra Fazina is the real deal. She's very committed, she's very passionate, she's very dedicated, and she's very brave. Here's Alexandra. You come from a fine art background, basically. That was your initial practice.
Yes, I studied fine art at university. Which sounds a bit far removed, perhaps, from photography. But in actual fact, I don't think the two are so dissimilar, even though I was perhaps painting and drawing back then rather than using a camera. The main reasons I always think about, really, is fine art, compared to other artistic disciplines, is very self-motivated. Nobody's telling you what to do. You don't have a brief. So in effect, it's about making up your own ideas for a project, which is often very in-depth, and then going out and doing it and actually pushing those ideas, like really forcing yourself to take them as far down the line as you possibly can. You haven't got a deadline to hand it in a week's time, as if you were a designer or something, and then take it forward and actually realise it. So learning those skills in life, I think, was something very important to me. But yes, during my time studying fine art, I worked a lot on some, I suppose, quite action-based projects and documentary-type ideas. I studied the difference, for example, between subjectivity and objectivity in war reporting. And for my finals, I documented the training course with a military regiment, which was actually the Armoured Ambulance Division. So a little bit like MASH, I suppose. And I spent my final year with them preparing before they went to go into conflict. And the day I left university, I went with them to Bosnia.
Wow. So, but had you had an interest in conflict before that?
Yes, funnily enough, I suppose I had. But I'm not obsessed with it. I wasn't fascinated by it. If I can think, throw back to my youth, I was very interested always in poetry from war, maybe. Mm. I was, perhaps when I was a teenager, was exactly the same time that all those Vietnam films came out of the cinema. Mm. And I spent a lot of time watching those. My first time I was ever allowed to stay up late to go to bed was during the Falklands War. And I actually collected magazines and things about it. So I was about 8 or 9 years old then, which are all on my shelf here as wow. well. I suppose I was very interested. I'm really not sure why. I don't have any sort of background in it. I mean, I was just a bit of a tomboy and was not particularly brought up as a girl in any way. And it was just one of the things I was interested in. It wasn't my main obsession. But also, I suppose, there's a grounding there because I got sort of brought up in this sort of very boyish way of where you fit in or where your role is as a woman in all of this, I think is something that always fascinates you growing up as a teenager because it is a sort of very man's world in a sense.
Yeah, and you can kind of see how the seeds of these things, you know, kind of would stand you in good stead when it came to, you know, this future life in photography that you had. But did you have siblings then?
One sister.
Okay. But you were the tomboy. You were the kind of...
Yes.
The tomboy daughter. But this thing of learning the business of not just doing your art practice, but as you say, to sort of push it and to really be kind of very self-contained and to, you know, make sure that you bring it to fruition. I guess that also was a skill that you then took into your photography practice once you started doing sort of long-term projects and stuff.
Yes, that's definitely something that's really informed me. I think it's probably if I look back to my university, it's probably the most useful thing I've learned. And it probably took me a few years to realise that that was actually what was good about it. But definitely I'm someone that loves investigating and exploring. And even when I very, very first started out in photography, it wasn't of particular interest to me. The very first commissions I got as a photographer as such in Bosnia was more because I had a camera. And the only reason I had a camera with me was I was carrying around a lot of paints and pens and paper. And the camera was just a recording device. It was
right,
sort of another tool in my... Yeah.
Yeah.
In the box.
So let's go to Bosnia, because that's, you know, it kind of neat piece of timing that, you know, literally the day you finished, you went as a war artist. Were you invited to
yeah,
go?
Yeah, I went there as an official war artist. And then after that, I got 3 or 4 commissions from different military regiments and from the National Army Museum and things, which was great since I just left university and really helped me just continue with my work. I also got a grant from the Arts Council. I had a studio in Tuzla and was painting there, working with some of the war graves that they were uncovering during that period. But everything I was doing was essentially very much documentary-based. Even working as an official war artist, I had a media pass to be in the war zone, so to speak. And I used to sort of make it my job to go to regular press conferences and things because I wanted to know what was going on around me. And if something was interesting was happened, I wanted to go and cover it. So it definitely really helped set me up in terms of, I suppose, a more journalistic practice or with my photography.
Yeah, you can kind of see how the transition, you know, having one foot in each camp in a way. And then at some point, you sort of became a proper, a full-on photographer. What was the next thing you did after you got back from Bosnia then?
Well, I stayed in Bosnia and ended up living with in a house full of artists in Sarajevo.
After the war had finished?
Well, yes. It was after the Dayton Peace Accords. It was still a little bit fractious then, but yeah, I lived in a house with DJs and artists and things in Sarajevo and started to actually use photography as almost a way to fund some of my artwork because I was actually getting paid jobs from newspapers. And I suppose the other thing that really set me up during that time in Bosnia was understanding how access works, who you need to speak to. I got to know a lot of members of the press. And I suppose over the coming years, and with the following trips that I then did in Kosovo and in Sierra Leone, for example, I knew all the right people to get on the ground.
Right. So you were learning the ropes, as it were, really, as far as how to operate, you know, as a photographer in those sorts of...
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it sort of led me to become an accidental photographer in a way, but it also gave me all the skills I needed to get on the ground. And I think a lot of the newspapers at the time, I remember coming back to London and speaking to editors, and they were like, oh, wow, you can get there. You know the right people.
Mm.
And that led me not just to get assignments back then, and we're going back almost 20 years now. But it also helped me almost get jobs because back then I was actually getting not just go for a couple of weeks and just cover this story. It was go for a couple of months or spend 6 months on the ground as a photographer. It really got me into situ quite quickly.
Yeah, yeah. So how did you end up in Somalia? You went to West Africa.
Yeah, so I've been working in West Africa during the conflicts there. In Sierra Leone and Liberia. And I also worked on quite an in-depth project in Nigeria back then. I covered most of West Africa. And over the next 7 years, I carried on photographing for the media around Africa, doing various different things. And I did a few more in-depth projects. I worked during the war in Angola. I was sort of one of the first people to go kind of behind the front lines with Joseph Savimbi. I worked during the Ethiopia-Eritrea war on a project there, and also in northern Uganda, which I actually worked over 2 years, which again, it started off as getting a lot of press assignments or NGO assignments that would get me on the ground, but then I would stay for another few months each time and started to build up my contacts. Because so much of what I did was really about covering war. I mean, really being in a flak jacket and being with troops on front lines with, you know, various things from the African Union, whether it's UN peacekeepers to local rebel groups and battalions, that in places like Congo, you could sort of literally go and sleep in the bush with and actually document them. To me, getting very, very quickly fed up with doing anything to do with, I suppose, this sort of testosterone-fueled environment. And I suppose it was sort of my ambition to take that out of war and spend my own time or invest my own practice in trying to document what was going on around it.
Right. Because, yeah, you know, this, I guess, inherent in the whole business of doing that kind of work is that, you know, there's the actual bang-bang, as they say, and all that kind of, like you say, macho stuff. And covering that, which, you know, I guess, you know, it's perfectly valid to cover it. But then I think one becomes aware of the fact that the people who actually are suffering, the consequences of that are quite often not apparent initially. You know, that it's the
I think the so. Civilians. And I think what's very interesting, if I look back at my work from that period and perhaps some of my other contemporaries in photography as well, whether they be men or women, I mean, we were photographing, I mean, everything was in black and white, of course, on film. We're, you know, carrying around scanners and darkroom equipment and everything wherever we went. It was quite crazy if I think about my packing list back then and trying to even file pictures of terrible internet connections.
Oh, man, yeah.
On with generators from the middle of nowhere and what have you. But essentially, if you look back at the work, I find it quite frightening because in a weird way, it sort of is what has come to inform people about Africa, about conflicts and what was going on in the world, and it was kind of through our eyes, but then it was in essence because we were taking those pictures for the media and also because of their editing and what have you is what we came to see and what the world understood. I mean, this kind of plays out in lots of different things. I can recall being asked to photo-document a famine before and being told off by an editor for not having pictures that were strong enough, you know, that weren't enough starving children. You're like, but that's not the story.
Right.
This isn't what's going on here. And really having to kind of fight with the media. And I suppose all of those things really pushed me into trying to do something that was more realistic, that was more true, I suppose, and more personable. Because at the end of the day, as a photographer, I feel really, really privileged. You know, like you have this little black box around your neck, and this little box gets you into all these places and into all these people's lives. Like, I'm so, so lucky that I've been able to do this. And, you know, my mum always used to say to me, like, everybody has a story. Like, you have to stop and listen to people. And I think that's what I really like about my work. Is actually going in and spending time with people and spending long time with people and really getting to understand them. So,
which is the kind of direct opposite of what you're doing with that other stuff. With
exactly.
Sort of, yeah, which is all very kind of in and out. And but did you take, before you got fed up with it, did you take to that life? Because it's a very particular thing and you've got to be a very particular kind of person to thrive under those circumstances, I think.
Well, I think there's lots of little skills that people probably don't realise. Like, touch wood, I'd never got ill. I mean, I've had malaria once or something, but I'm somebody that's a good traveller. You have to move very fast. There's a lot of adrenaline. But also, I suppose the time I spent with the British Army also taught me that.
What about, you know, the impact of seeing that degree of suffering going on in front of your camera? Did you have a way to somehow protect yourself from that?
I don't think you do. And I mean, I can look back to, I remember one incident, and I was working with Rory Carroll, who used to be the Africa correspondent for The Guardian back then. And it was in Uganda, and we came across a massacre one morning. Somebody called us about 4 o'clock in the morning, and we went out into the bush, and there was lots of chopped up bodies, burnt bodies, pieces of bodies. And we actually went there with the families as they were returning to their village for the first time since it was attacked the night before. It was a really just horrific scene. And I can remember just standing there and looking through my camera, just busy framing everything. Everything was fitting into a rectangle, and I'm just busy, you know, taking everything in. And then turning around to Rory, who was stood with his notepad, who was just having a breakdown, and thinking, are you okay? And realizing that he actually had to really look. And then I had this realization that as a photographer, we don't really, really do that sometimes. We're so busy framing and looking through a lens that we don't often see life around us so much. And I think there's a lot of photographers and people's work I see who are still very guilty of that, who don't ever take in the bigger picture, so to speak, or really get a good grasp on what they're doing.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I suppose you could argue that, that it's a necessity, because if you do lose it and then you don't get the pictures, then in a way you might as well not be there. And I think I've heard that argument, and I think there is some, you
it
know,
is an argument, funny. But I think what also was troubling then is then you can, you know, when you're away and you're busy working, you get on with the next thing and something else happens the next day which might be equally dramatic. But then I suppose as a photographer, the difference is when you get back home, you develop your film, you look at the contact sheets, you scan it, you see it big on a screen, and then perhaps you start looking more closely. And I remember seeing things I didn't actually perhaps really see when I was on the ground. And that somehow always goes through your work, because I'm still looking at those pictures now. I still have to rescan my archive. I still have to send them off for certain things. Like, they never leave you. So the trouble is, once you are a photographer and you've taken these pictures, you're never going to get rid of them. You can never put them down. I can never put them in a file in my filing cabinet and think, okay, those negs have gone. I'm done with those. Because they're there. They're part of your work. And unfortunately, you always sort of have to live with them. And I think that does burn quite a deep hole.
Yeah, and I was wondering if whether it kind of, you know, can have an impact on your faith in human nature, because you're seeing the darkest human behavior imaginable, and most of us are pretty much protected from that. You know, you might see something in the newspaper, but we're all just getting on with our daily lives. And how does it make you feel about you know, the darkness?
I mean, yes, everybody is getting on with their daily lives, but at the same time, I know, even living in the center of London, there's a huge culture of violence around me. And in some ways, you can actually choose to drift through London and not even see it or turn away from it. But there's a lot right on our doorsteps as well, I think, I would ask just as many questions about. And it troubles me just as much that, say, youths in London live with so much violence, and it doesn't trouble them as I would with somebody in a war zone.
Yeah, that's kind of scary, the way in which some of these young people are sort of desensitized to such an extent. You know, it's horrific.
But it's exactly the same as working in a war zone with child soldiers or something, like right. How people can become desensitized. And, you know, I've always been very, very fascinated, you know, what war does to you, or what even a violent act or something, how quickly things can creep up on our lives. I mean, I spend my whole time when I'm out thinking, what if it was me? If this was me? And it's these little things. I mean, I love having these very deep conversations with people about, well, you know, what happened when the war started? Well, it's not about, you know, somebody came to my house and shot my husband in the face, which, you know, I've heard countless times as well. But it's more the little creep of things, that it's just sort of one minute we took our children to school and the school was closed, which was very strange. And then the policeman disappeared from our village. And then we went to the bank to get some money, or to the bank machine, and it wasn't working. And then our phones got cut off. And you just think, these small little trickles that you learn to live with very quickly.
And it's banal, you know, it's the banality of evil, as they say. You know,
exactly.
Kind of, yeah. And didn't you get taken captive at some point?
Yes, it was something I don't really talk about very much, though. But yes, I was.
Why? Because you don't want to think about it too much?
Not particularly that, but I don't think it is something that has particularly had such a huge impact on my career. And I'm not somebody that wants to talk normally really about myself.
No.
I mean, even talking to you now and doing this podcast, people.
Yeah, but this is the one
what
time.
What I understand is that people, though, I mean, my work is about telling other people's stories. And I find it very, very curious that anybody can be interested in me.
Mm.
This is something, but I realize, you know, when I've done talks and things or when I'm teaching, you know, I can talk about what happened to some lady and the consequences of war, and they'll say, but what were you wearing or where were you staying? And I think, why is that even interesting? It's yeah, as you said, so banal compared to this bigger picture.
Yeah.
But people are fascinated in those things.
Well, I think, I mean, clearly this is the context in which you get to talk about these things, he says. But
yeah, so I suppose it's me trying not to put myself at the centre of my work.
Which is
so
laudable.
I mean, yes, I was held hostage in Liberia during the war, and I was a political hostage. So I was actually taken under the orders of Charles Taylor. It was incredibly frightening.
I guess the reason I'm asking is because it makes me wonder, you know, what is it in your character that allowed you to process something like that happening? It didn't prevent you from continuing your job.
And no, and it makes me wonder sometimes what's in my character, why I feel very, very compelled to keep throwing myself into quite precarious environments. And even I was quite conscious after I had a child that I wouldn't be in perhaps such a fractious war zone.
Yeah.
But then I found myself working with with criminal, like really in a deep world of criminality and with smugglers. And
well, this is what I was going to ask you about.
Actually potentially more dangerous.
Yeah, very much so.
Than perhaps even when you've got bullets flying over your head. But then I suppose what compels me is that somehow I seem to get a lot of access. This is really, this is what I feel is almost my skill.
Mm. I think
perhaps
it is
because
fundamental.
I'm quite unassuming. And people trust me a lot.
Mm.
They seem to take me to me very easily. Even, you know, the last couple of months I've, you know, spoken to women and they've said, no, we refuse to speak to a journalist. I mean, my translator in Yemen just said, no, this journalist came, this woman, and I didn't want to speak to her. And I said, but why did you speak to me? What's the difference? Mm.
So it wasn't just that you were a woman. I mean,
that
can sometimes be a factor.
So somehow, yeah, people just sort of take me under their wing. And whether that's smugglers or leaders of militia or something, I mean, for sure, there's definitely this machismo that I keep, you know, that also reoccurs to me that happens a lot where people will just say, okay, I want to have this female photographer with me because I want to photograph this. But then, funnily enough...
Well, you're in a way, you're a sort of a novelty to some extent to those kind of people because they don't expect a woman to be... in that context.
Yes, but also I'm not the photographer. I mean, I can think of other female photographers who do similar things and perhaps they really like photographing the bad boys.
Mm.
I can think of female photographers who've got lots of pictures of the Taliban or something. Mm. And, you know, I might have pictures of them, but they're not at the heart of my work.
Yeah,
almost sort of on the side. So perhaps also it's obvious that I don't really care about them and I'm not really very impressed.
Right, yeah.
Which is probably what they want me to be. That then maybe it makes them...
They're sort of posturing and they wouldn't... Yeah. But quickly, though, before... I mean, do I want to talk about this? This is really critical and it takes us into A Million Shillings, and which is your kind of major book project, and into Somalia. But those 4 days that you were captive, what, you know, kind of how did you pass that... Obviously, you know, to some extent, there's nothing you can do. But I presume at some point you must have... feared for your life at some stage during that period, if not for the whole of it.
Yeah, I mean, I was held up by a firing squad in the jungle for hours at a time.
Oh, right.
Kalashnikovs
didn't know that.
Pointing at me.
Well, that's horrific.
So, yes, of course, you think any moment that's it.
Yeah.
And for what? I mean, you're never going to change the world as a photographer, right? I mean, what really impact are you having? Is your life really worth it?
Mm.
But I suppose... I just think of it, like you said, I think about it, I'm trying to tell people's stories. And I want to hear people's stories. So there is something that, yes, I might be really scared. And yes, I suppose at the end of the day, those things do stay with you. I can remember after I was released and I got on a plane with a correspondent from the BBC in Monrovia, and somebody joking and laughing and saying, oh, this will make a great dinner party conversation one day. And I just thought, how dare you? You know, I've just been kidnapped and held hostage.
They didn't have to go through it.
Yeah, but at the same time, I mean, yes, I'm not going to turn around and talk about it. And it is something that was very serious. But yeah, it didn't, at the end of the day, it shook me up, but it didn't stop me from going and working.
Well, there must be some kind of steeliness to you, which I guess is what sort of fascinates me. I mean, we'll talk about Somalia, because the story that you chose to pursue in A Million Shillings was about people trafficking, basically. So this was, in a way, your attempt to, you know, go against the thing that we've already talked about.
The focus of my work really for some time had, you know, as I said, it was about the consequences of war, what was going on behind the picture. And of course, you know, during wars, most people lose their homes is, you know, one of the biggest fallbacks. So yes, it's, you know, migration and refugees is something that began to be a very, very big focus of my work. I'd been working previously in the Middle East quite a bit as well. I mean, I'd covered also the war in Iraq and things too. And I'd been working, I mean, my geographical spread of my work has always been quite focused. Like, I spent 7 years just in Africa, but then it started to go up towards the Middle East, and sort of Somalia and the Gulf of Aden being in that kind of bridge between the two, I suppose, was a sort of natural path to where I went in that sense. Although strangely, when I first started the project, it was much less specific. It wasn't about people trafficking or smuggling or just about refugees. It was actually that I was very, very interested in the Gulf of Aden, which isn't a country, obviously it's a sea, you know, and surrounded by Yemen and Djibouti and Somalia. And the traffic of people between the countries was just one of the elements that I started to photograph when I first started to look into the region and research it.
All right. And then at some point, it became the focus, or you made a decision that was where...
Yeah, I mean, the first time I went, I had a commission from the Sunday Times magazine. So I, instead of going for a couple of weeks, I actually went for a couple of months and tried to explore all the way around the coast of the Gulf of Aden. And I actually met some of the pirates from Somalia, and I went out with them. I covered some of the people smuggling. I looked at illegal fishing. I looked at weapons trafficking. I went on patrol with the Joint Task Force and from the Gulf, who also patrol the region because of the war in Somalia and what have you. So I covered lots of different angles. Mm. But again, I mean, I'm really a people person. So I suppose when I came back and I thought, I want to do some more work on this, it was the people side of the story. It was the refugees that I very much wanted to go back and focus on.
Yeah. So sort of in order to do that, you had to make contact with some very nasty people. And I think we've sort of already alluded to this to some extent, because your ability to do that, you know, as you say, the way you'd learned really about access and about, and also, you know, you're obviously just the sort of person who people will accept. I mean, that all suddenly came into play, I suppose.
Yes, I mean, the first trip I made into Somalia, I literally went on a civilian flight and just landed by myself and sort of accidentally found a translator to work with. But the focus of my work was about refugees. So everything I said to people, I said, what are you doing here? Because it's always people's first questions. And I think as a photographer, you should always be very, very clear what you're doing, was to look at the refugees trying to go to Yemen, which actually, funnily enough, have a name. They're called the Tarib. And it's a name that actually means almost like a smuggle person. It's used across the Arabian Peninsula. So I was sort of very clear that I was going to look at them, and I wanted to know why they were fleeing, the reasons they were escaping either war in Somalia or poverty or persecution in Ethiopia. And I wanted to talk to them about their journeys. So I had a very, very clear motive. But obviously lots of those people who were traveling with the smugglers. So the smugglers knew I was around, but again, I didn't make it my main aim to speak to them first.
Right.
Because I was very aware that they would be watching me, somebody would know what I was up to, and of course, very soon that they came to me. Mm. And in fact, that's a similar pattern. It happened to me again in Turkey. I was working with Afghan children, and I spent a month in one area of Istanbul. And you know, after 2 or 3 weeks, the smugglers found me, not right. The other way around.
It's funny, isn't it, the way that tends to happen? It's almost like people feel like left out or something. Like, why aren't I the subject of this?
Well, the first time I, on my very first trip to Somalia, I established that there were 8 different gangs of people smugglers. I was working in a town on the northerly coast where people depart on these very dangerous boats to Yemen from. And one of the smugglers contacted me. And I didn't ask for very much access. I just asked to one of the safe houses, something very simple, like, okay, well, can you give me access to people as they're being put on a truck? Or can I see that? I'm not interested in you. I'm just interested in the refugees. But then, strangely, he very much wanted to be photographed. And there's actually a picture in my book, I think is one of probably the most famous pictures of this chap, Omar. And he very much wanted to be part of the story. But then my second trip, when I came back, I kind of bumped into him again. And he was so proud and so happy to see me that he took me under his wing, literally. And everything started to open up to me. So at places I had tried to go before where our car came under fire, I mean, we really got shot at a lot. Now I could suddenly go to, and I could go with his militia and access these areas and departure points for the smuggling. But then, of course, there were these 7 other gangs, and they all got quite jealous. So they all wanted sort of a piece of it. And it really does surprise me. You think, well, twice after I came back from that trip, there were two occasions where other journalists were actually held hostage by those smuggling gangs. And why was it they didn't take me? Because I was all on my own. You know, it would have been very, very easy to get make money out of me as well.
You're a lone female. That's, you know, kind of a very vulnerable category to be in.
For
any kind of, you know, particularly cowardly
people.
And also
they're incredibly dangerous, incredibly volatile. I mean, I saw refugees being executed, shot in front of me. If I was pointing my camera at somebody and they didn't like it, they would just shoot at me as well. I mean,
Jesus. But is there any consequences for when those things happen for these people? Or is it completely
lawless?
No, they
work in complete perpetuity, because both the areas they work in Somalia and in Yemen, were both controlled by Al-Qaeda.
Right. So there's no legal recourse.
There's no way that someone can get to them. And yeah, really, these guys are kind of really, there is no law for them to even be above, really.
Yeah. So consequently, why would they worry about being photographed in a way? You know,
you could say that. But then I do wonder why they'd kidnap these other journalists and not me.
Well, again,
And I think...
Didn't they shoot at your feet or something?
Yeah, I mean, they were constantly shooting at me. And you can laugh. I mean, they were laughing at
Well, you say it so casually.
No, but they would... I mean, really, they would just do it to scare me. They would fire over my shoulder at sort of a metre or two away, you know, as if we're sitting across the table, which is incredibly frightening.
Yeah, of course.
They would fire around my feet. I mean, everything to them was this sort of game. And they really had absolutely no regard for human life at all. And not least for the refugees.
Clearly, yeah.
Whether that was sort of throwing them all overboard from the boats, like I said, to executing people in the back of the head because they were too scared to travel with them. I mean, raping women during the night times, where I slept in the mountains several times with the refugees. And they were, you know, it was really disgusting, their behaviour. I mean, yeah, absolutely no regard for anybody at all. So, you know, there were at times I really was very, very scared. And of course, they could have kidnapped me at any point. But again, I think it was more that I was unassuming. I'm there, I'm working off my own back. I don't have much money. I've got one Leica around my neck. I'm wearing flip-flops and an abaya. Whereas I think the other journalists that turned up to sort of try and do the same story had turned up with thousands of dollars, big cameras, and went straight for the story, so to speak. They didn't spend time navigating the area, getting to know the people, and just sort of threw themselves into it. You know, sometimes if you were a TV crew or from a big media channel, you have the ability to do that because you have fixers and you have money and things. But also it maybe makes it more dangerous.
Well, I think that's a great learning in a way, that's how it seems to me from, you know, people I've spoken to and from what experience I have, that is how it should be done, the way that you went about it. If you have the luxury of time, I suppose, especially.
I think time is sort of what, in essence, when you're even taking the act of taking a photograph, having time is really, paramount. I mean, there's one side of photography where you could say it's street photography and you're snapping something. But to get something really in-depth that connects, I think you really, really need that time. And it also takes time to get the access and to really understand. You know, it took me 2 or 3 trips to Somalia, really, to get that kind of access. And it also, in terms of security, I also spent perhaps a lot of that first trip speaking to local militia leaders, to the elders, to religious leaders, all of which actually helped to give me security, because they spoke to some of the gangs and things operating there and kind of instructed them to look after me too. So that was another thing I did. So it was really about taking my time.
Well, let's sort of talk a little bit about the, you know, some of those people who were the victims, as it were. Well, they were the victims very much, because a lot of them didn't make it. In fact, probably the majority don't actually make it.
No, not the majority. I mean, it's very hard to look at statistics because, when I was working on this project, it wasn't something that people were reporting on. It wasn't something that NGOs were working on. The only statistics available were from the UN, which they knew really roughly how many people were arriving in Yemen through one reception centre. But they weren't, you know, weren't aware of how many people were leaving. And during the course of the project, which was 2 years, I actually based myself in Yemen in order to work on it, because the project spans essentially the two countries. My estimate was that 1 in 20 people died.
Okay, yeah.
And that was because I had my translators in Somalia telling me when boats were leaving, how many people were on each boat, and I can then judge how many people were actually arriving in Yemen. Right. Whereas, of course, somebody like the United Nations don't know how many people boarded the boat in Somalia every day.
Mm.
And certainly even when I was working in Yemen and trying to photograph the boats arriving, which was also incredibly difficult. It was a 1,200-kilometer-long seaboard along the southern shore of Yemen. Again, like I said, an area controlled by al-Qaeda. There was a war down there then at the time.
Mm.
So it was very, very difficult working down there. So it wasn't as if we're in Greece or something more recently and we can see boats coming in the distance.
Mm.
I mean, really, you have very little idea where they're coming. So it was very tough. But during the times I was there and the weeks I spent down there and had permission from the military to do this, I mean, I just saw hundreds of bodies.
Because people drowned some of the time.
They drown, they get thrown overboard. Some of them get shot in the back of the head before they go overboard. They also come under fire by the Yemeni military. There's lots
wasn't
of different
there,
reasons.
Just to sort of kind of personalise it further, wasn't there a pregnant girl? Wasn't that one of the people that you focused on?
Yeah, because what I did for my book is I took this story from the very beginning of when people were escaping from the conflict and things through. So I followed the refugees not just when they arrived in Yemen, but also through to refugee camps, to them trying to make new lives, and then sometimes even looking for a better life in another country, like many of them would carry on their journeys to Saudi Arabia. So yeah, when I was working in Aden, I worked in a big slum there called B13 that was very densely populated by Somalis. And again, strangely enough, I found 8 smuggling gangs in that particular slum. Because they also prey on vulnerable people, of course, and the new arrivals and things coming from Yemen on a daily basis were very vulnerable and often had nothing. So there was a lot of trafficking, because, of course, traffickers explore people who've got nowhere to stay, who've got no money. They'll give them hope and get them to rack up debts before they're trafficked. And so it was in one of these houses one day. I was working quite quietly, doing a lot of interviews. I met a teenage girl called Salima, who'd her child and her husband were actually killed in Mogadishu as they went out to buy bread. And she was pregnant at the time, 7 months pregnant, and decided to escape, but she had nothing left to lose. So she went with this people smugglers through Somalia, which is a dangerous journey in itself, and took the boat to Yemen, and actually went into labour on the boat. And she told me that she basically passed out. Some of the other women on the boat helped her. I mean, there was blood everywhere. And the only thing she can remember is this coming round and seeing the baby. He was alive, everything was fine. And then the smugglers taking the baby, and they threw him into the sea as if he was a ball, and just slung him overboard. In a way, it doesn't really surprise me, because anybody on those boats who even moved or kicked up a fuss would be thrown overboard and thrown to the sharks. But anyway, you can imagine this girl arriving, the teenage girl, everything in her life must be destroyed. I mean, it even makes me kind of shake thinking about it now. And then I met her in one of these traffickers' houses. And so, of course, she's one of these most vulnerable people. And some of the other women there were being sent out to beg to make money. But I thought about her story a lot after I did the interview, because it took me almost the whole day. We had to go very, very slowly. It was so difficult speaking to her and, you know, also trying to be as considerate as possible to her feelings too. And then I decided to go back a few days later and think, let me go and see her again and see how she is. Because I'm also somebody that always kind of goes back as well to people and places. And she'd gone. So what I can only assume is that she was probably trafficked to Saudi Arabia and was probably enslaved as a housemaid or something like that.
Yeah, that's pretty shocking. So the book is called A Million Shillings, and that's the price of passage.
Yeah, the title, it's a great sort of title. Came to me because, yeah, for each person that wanted to travel to Yemen, the price of the journey was a million shillings, which in Somali money is sort of a big carrier bag full of notes.
Yeah.
But it's actually only $50, which sounds very cheap, but it's a lot of money for people in Somalia. But to me, really, this was the price of life. I mean, with 1 in 20 people dying and the smugglers willing to kill people for $50, it just seemed life was so, so cheap. So, yeah, that became the title of a book that I subsequently did with Trolley Books from London.
I always noticed the pictures are quite dark, literally. Is that a conscious attempt at sort of reflecting the darkness of the subject matter?
It's quite strange because before that, I've always been a black and white photographer.
Mm.
And actually, that project is the first project I did in colour.
Oh, really?
The first time I went to shoot, or maybe the first two times, because the book is actually shot on various different mediums, I took a lot of black and white film. And actually, none of those pictures actually ended up being in the book, but some were published in the Sunday Times and in other magazines. But no, I think it was sort of very reflective of these quite dirty colours of what the environment was. And actually, quite quickly, I started to sort of see, when I started shooting the digital part of it, the second year of the project, perhaps, that there was these kind of colour waves that were really reflective of, you know, where people were living. And I suppose the other thing is that this was probably one of the first digital cameras as well, the first digital camera that Leica made, and it's kind of got this funny look.
Right, it's not
as sort of technologically advanced as some, but I quite like it.
Yeah.
So it was kind of accidental, but actually probably quite true to what I was seeing.
Yeah.
And strangely, since then, I really see myself as a colour photographer much, much more.
Yeah.
And I really love to play with colour now.
Right. Well, the other thing that always comes up is that you've got this sort of painterly style, which I do think is noticeably the case. And, you know, is that a reflection of your original fine art background, or is that, again, am I reading too much into it?
I think a lot of people have tried to read that into it.
Sometimes that is a danger.
I mean, it's sort of also a little bit, I used to paint in quite a similar way too, so perhaps, but without thinking.
Subconscious.
Because I've really got to say that, for me, the aesthetics is not what's important about my work. It really has to come secondary. And certainly when I was editing my book, it really, really had to. I could have put together just all my favourite pictures.
I was going to ask you about the editing.
And in fact, some of my, what I thought were the strongest or the most beautiful images or something, are not in there at all. Because at the end of the day, I had to tell a story. And so I ended up having to sort of put in pictures that I wasn't really happy with. They didn't come out brilliantly.
But they were all linked together. The narrative.
Yes, exactly. So the narrative definitely came first. And, you know, while there's always a sort of a small amount of aesthetic will come into your concerns when you're editing, it definitely wasn't there. It wasn't paramount. It wasn't something I particularly thought of.
And
it
did
had
you,
to be about the narrative.
Did you have help with that process, or did you pretty much take that on your own?
No,
in terms
in fact,
of
that was a very difficult process because to be frank, some of that work, and especially the work I did in Yemen with the new arrivals, was somehow more traumatic than a lot of the other work I'd done in war zones. I mean, just the sheer amount of dead bodies I was seeing, it really did play with my head quite badly. And also, you know, it's very, doing a long-term project like that is even perhaps more lonely than most of the other work I've done as a photographer. So you really do have to sort of absorb it. And I came back to London afterwards to try and start editing it at Trolley. And I just had to walk away from it. It's very hard to edit, of course, when you're very close to the work and you've just completed it. But two, I found it very, very difficult. And in fact, I took a year or two to go back to the editing, which wasn't till a much later date, and I was actually living in Pakistan doing it really quite remotely, that I could almost face it.
Mm.
So I really, really needed some distance.
Yeah, I'm not
between
surprised.
When I finished work and when I did it. But yes, the main concern was always the narrative.
Well, the other thing is, on that topic, in a way, that there's quite a lot of text in the book, which is something that, you know, some photographers actively seek to avoid. But is that also part of the fact that for you, the story is more important, and therefore, if you've got text to support the pictures, you know, you're conveying more information to
Think if I just wrote a book about Somali refugees, nobody would read it.
Right.
But the fact that there is some photographs there that lead you into people's stories, almost like extended captions, I think they do draw you in.
Yeah.
And perhaps people would actually find themselves reading a book that they otherwise wouldn't have done. But then on the flip side, it has been read by book clubs in America and things, which is also quite surprising too. But yes, it was very important for me to tell people's stories. And I do like writing. And I think this definitely needed a sort of a written narrative thread to go with the pictures. Yes, you could explain it by themselves, of course. I think sometimes when I've seen exhibitions and things of the work, I think, well, it's quite obvious what the story's about.
Mm.
But I think, yeah, it's a way, it's sort of a communication tool. And that's also in a way, you know, like I said, I could have done a set of very beautiful photographs, but also why I have this sort of quite small book, because I want people to look closely and I want people to read it. And it to be something that becomes an intimate story. And for me, it's all about telling people stories and people actually engaging with it. And I found it very curious, you know, since when, you know, afterwards, the book had a lot of traction, really. It gave me a really good platform to go and speak about refugees or, you know, troubles in Somalia, whether it be on the radio or to governments or something.
So it got traction outside of the little photo book,
yes,
photographer ghetto that we're all sort of so familiar with.
The other really important consideration I had for making a book, and I think it should be everybody's consideration when they make any piece of work, is who's your audience.
Right, and how big is it?
And it doesn't matter so much about the size. I think that can come or it can go. But for me, it just shouldn't be people going to galleries or other photographers or other editors. It had to be something broader, at least. I mean, hopefully wider, but definitely broader. It had to engage on a number of different levels. So, yeah, like I said, even somebody from a book club reading it is a huge leap.
Yeah.
You know, a group of people when I launched it at the Photographer's Gallery in London. But, I mean, I was really surprised sort of how much leverage it did have. I mean, like I said, it really gave me a platform to go and speak about the issues in the book. I really wanted it to be a piece of advocacy. And also one of the ways that I actually got it published or paid for to be published was the IOM, the International Office of Migration, paid for the publication of the book. And they actually used it as a piece of advocacy, which meant that it went out to sort of every donor who gave money to refugees in the whole region and got put on people's desks rather than a report. And they actually managed to do a huge amount of fundraising for refugees in the Horn of Africa and in Yemen, which was amazing. I then published it a year later in Arabic with the help of the European Union. And again, each copy sold raised money for refugee children in Yemen. And again, the Arabic edition went to further donors and governments within the Arab-speaking world, so which also helped them to donate money. Because, of course, most money or fundraising is done not through people's individual pockets, but it's sort of large amounts coming from governments.
Mm.
So it really, the book actually helped them as a tool to put the issue on the table and get a lot of recognition from the issue. So of course there was a lot of editorial press on it, which meant once I had the book as well, which meant that the issue got out there further. And then, you know, curiously, a few years ago, I'm trying to remember the year now, it also was nominated for the Prix Pictet Award, which means up until last year, it's sort of been touring major museums around the world as well. So it's sort of carried on. And it sort of made me very curious, like, why would a piece of work, which is about Somali refugees, which most people have really no interest in, be nominated sort of at the same time there was this so-called refugee crisis going on in Europe? Like, why is this work still important? Like, why does it connect with people more than other things we're seeing? And I suppose, you know, my brain ticking is all about, well, audience, because I've actually become quite fed up personally of looking at a lot of work on refugees. And while everything was going on in Europe, I just had my baby, and I remember sitting there thinking, why do I want to turn the page? I don't even want to look at the pictures. Why do I not feel connected with this issue? And I sort of sat down with a newborn baby and started to academically study about, I suppose, visualising migration and what's going wrong. But maybe it was also a challenge to myself, because I have to think, well, what's the next thing I do? That I need to do it in a way where it really will connect with people, because I don't want to fail.
Did you find an answer to that question, though?
I think I found lots of different types of answers. I mean, especially looking at the ways people are depicted and the angles, even where people are photographed from. I mean, if you look at the famous picture from A Million Shillings of people boarding the boat, it's very, very different than pictures we've seen of people arriving in Lesbos or something. And I think, well, why? Well, because normally you often see, and the very cliched images of refugees are they're all coming towards you. They're coming towards the viewer. Whereas perhaps that picture is we're seeing them going away and looking back at us and that kind of connection. So I think when people disrupt those kind of frames, it changes you. But also, I think I just don't feel engaged with any people. There's very little work. There is some really great work that's been done, but very little that seems to really care or makes me care, or I understand that these are actually individual people with individual lives, which I suppose is sort of the battle that you have in trying to construct these narratives.
Yeah, but it sounds like in a way that the traction that book did get, it was, you know, you couldn't have asked for more in a way, because you weren't necessarily expecting any of those things to come of it.
No, and also, I mean, I was awarded the Nansen Refugee Award.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
Which was really out of the blue. And I mean, I'm not a sort of photographer that enters for many awards or anything like that. I don't put my work out everywhere. I mean, I've been very fortunate to sort of get shortlisted for a few things, but I've been nominated rather than resending it off. So yeah, I was nominated for that. And I'm the first sort of photographer or journalist or anybody to ever won it. It's always...
Because it's a prize that could go to anyone.
It's been awarded to presidents, right. NGOs, like MSF have won it. So, you know, it's really incredible to be recognised for my work with refugees. And, of course, it wasn't just for A Million Shillings. It was for my work in general, because over the years I have done so much. But then following that, I was... helped through the UNHCR to work on a project. I was based in Pakistan at the time. I actually lived there for 6 years after I finished this project. And I worked on a project with Afghan refugees, which was one of the major themes I was working on in Pakistan, documenting the flow of unaccompanied minors, so children under 18 travelling on their own to Europe, which... was something, I began this just at the beginning of 2010. It was something that people knew nothing about, but it was something, again, when I think about doing projects, I try and sort of anticipate as well. I'm like, right, what's everyone interested in now? I try and think, what could people, or what will be in the news, or what is going to happen in the future? So even when I have meetings with people, I always think, well, what is it, what are your campaigns that you've got coming up, or what do you think, you know, is going to change or something. So again, that was sort of anticipating, in essence, what did happen with so many children coming to Europe.
So you're quite mindful of, almost that you're sort of doing research as you go, in a way.
Yeah, but then the route I followed was Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran, Turkey, and I did this, you know, the back end of it rather than so much the work in Europe. But it was incredibly difficult story because even although a million shillings was very, very hard to get the access, this was possibly even harder because I'm trying to work with smuggling gangs in Afghanistan who are linked to the president's office, and you know, I've got to get under their skin and also find people before they've set out on a journey.
And you were focusing on the children, was
just
that?
Just on children.
And this was the wider project was the Flowers of Afghanistan was the title for it. And was this pre-motherhood for you?
Yes, it was just afterwards. But then strangely, I sort of carried on with the project afterwards. One of the reasons as well, the project idea came to me is I was working in Afghanistan in the eastern city of Jalalabad. And I was doing some work with returnees from Pakistan then, people who were coming back. It was a little bit quieter then after the war just subsided for a little bit and people were taking the chance to return. And I was working in some of these settlements one day and there was a funeral and I asked who's the funeral is and what's going on in this camp. And they said, oh yeah, it's a young boy. He's just been his body was just repatriated from Turkey because he died on a boat traveling between Greece and Turkey. Like, okay. And I photographed the funeral. And the following day in a hospital, which was actually mostly for victims of mines and things, like a lot of people who'd lost their legs and limbs and been injured during the war, I met a young 14-year-old boy called Zahidullah and assumed that he'd been in an explosion. He had marks all over him, but actually they were torture marks.
Oh, God.
And he'd lost both of his legs and nearly his arms because he was kidnapped by people smugglers on the Turkish border near Iran and held hostage, which happens to a lot of people making that very, very long overland journey. And he was tied up with wires. They called his family, asked for thousands of dollars, which they didn't have because they were refugees. And he subsequently lost the circulation to his legs. So he was just dumped on the side of the road. And then I followed Zahid over the next couple of years. I used to go and visit his family in Peshawar in Pakistan and drink tea with them. And then one day he told me, yeah, I'm going again. I thought, what? You know, you've got no legs. He'd just learned to walk with prosthetic legs. In fact, he just learned to ride a bicycle. Mm. But his determination was so great. I was thinking, well, gosh, nothing would stop you. So it was really his story that kind of inspired me to take on board this project. And then even after my daughter was born, you know, I would get calls from translators in Pakistan or from his family and, you know, telling me, oh, he suddenly arrived in Austria. And because he was also kidnapped on the border of Hungary, I met him again in Greece when I was working there. He'd lost both his legs again, his prosthetic legs. And there was Afghan women and child died in front of him on a boat. Wow. Overturned in the river there on the Turkish border. So his sort of life and mine got a bit entwined. And I suppose there are always characters and people and things that I meet that I always sort of seem to return to.
That's an incredible story. What an example of kind of, you know, resilience and determination in the face of...
But I think it's the same. I mean, when I'm talking about what stories to do about refugees now... For me, it's really important to show that, you know, we have got this world on the move. There isn't never been as many refugees as ever before in history. Mm. People are constantly moving for lots of different reasons. And also those list of reasons is ever growing. And somehow I really want to show, this is one of my aims, is to show where the fears of migration really come from. That it shouldn't be from, you know, us in inverted commas or people in Europe or something. You know, the fear of migration for people actually leaving their homes or having to escape from conflict is huge. I mean, if you imagine having to pack up everything and leave your house and run for your life. I mean, that's where fear really comes from. I think, you know, it's a very privileged position to sit here and pretend to be scared of migration. Mm. And I suppose my work, I really want to sort of challenge that, is a big part of it.
Yeah. So how are... things progressing at the moment? How are you? I think you're in the business of following
the story. I've actually started to sort of, I suppose, return or follow up from A Million Shillings. I mean, I used to live, as I said, I used to live in Yemen. And I've been very interested in trying to do something in Yemen because of the conflict there, which is now into its fourth year. It's very, very hard now to access the country, though. And journalists are effectively banned. Even if they find out there's a journalist or somebody with a camera on the flight, the Saudis would close off the airspace for the flight. And they really don't want people. They're actively trying to stop people reporting on this war. But what I found very interesting is in the beginning of this year, the very Somali people that I saw escaping from Yemen were now being evacuated. And the slum called Bisatine, where I mentioned I worked in, was now a front line in the war. So all those places and the streets that I'd been photographing in my book, something very different has happened. So I managed to go at the beginning of this year and document the evacuation of Somali refugees from Yemen back to Somalia as they were being evacuated.
So it's the reverse journey.
So they're going back. And some of them have obviously been born in Yemen many years ago, never set foot in Somalia. Some of the elders haven't left for, 25 years, haven't seen their home country, which of course is still quite, there's conflict going on there as well. But also at the same time as doing that, there's also Yemenis arriving on a daily basis in Somalia. There's now a big community of Yemeni refugees in Mogadishu. And it's sort of this idea that people are jumping from one war zone to another. So I started to document that in Somalia and speak to Yemeni refugees as they got off the boat and urban refugees about their experiences of the conflict. And have since been back to work in Djibouti, which is the neighbouring country to Somalia, which is another route through to Yemen, which again, it's got these migration flows in two directions. So while you've got a camp for Yemeni refugees and again, many urban refugees and people arriving by boat on a daily basis there, you've also got 300 people a day going in the opposite direction to Yemen. So these flows of the movement of people are really going in two directions. It's very much compounded by the conflict. It's incredible that people will risk their life to go through conflict.
And why would you actively go to Yemen now when it's kind of like a total hellhole?
Exactly. I mean, many people are trying to travel to other destinations ultimately in the Middle East. But even so, the risk of traveling through a war zone and the smuggling gangs in Yemen are incredibly dangerous at the moment. There's huge risks of getting kidnapped. There's some quite horrible tales from the migrants. You have people going in and people going out on two different shores. So you've really got sort of almost like this huge movement of people in this very, very tiny space that sort of represents almost a microcosm of everything that's going on in terms of human flows around the world, because you've got people escaping from war, people from poverty, people from famine, people from persecution. So I'm trying to sort of delve into that and see what's happening. And I have met quite a few people that were in A Million Shillings as well, or who at least recognise me. Even documenting the evacuations to Somalia. I was in the port in Somalia and people were sort of waving at me that knew me.
Right.
And then I will go and speak to a family of Yemeni refugees, and they will have met me before and tell me where they met me in Yemen. And it's been really incredible because, again, I suppose with the connections I've got from living in Yemen, even speaking to somebody about what happened to them in the war, I know exactly where the house is. I know the streets. I know the country really well. So we can even talk about exactly where they were walking that day or which shop it was they went to in the market, because I know the geography. I know what's going on the ground.
Right.
And I've had some of the most incredible women, again, who've just taken me on board, who I've almost been living with. I haven't been over there living in hotels or anything. I'm just staying with the women and sitting up all night talking. And yeah, I've been getting some incredible narratives from them as well. So I've started to record that.
You speak the language?
I did speak okay Arabic when I lived in Yemen. I've forgotten it a bit now, but a little bit, so it helps me. It's an icebreaker at least, and I can ask some very basic questions, but I wouldn't say I'm fluent.
Right, okay. But you got something, yeah. Because, it sounds like it is the kind of a perfect follow-up in a way, because you've got these strands, these actual people who can kind of take you from one thing to the next. And is it going to be a book, do you think?
Let's see. I hope so. I'm just at the stage now where, again, I've worked I've got funding. I worked on assignment for a magazine so far, but it's a project I want to take forward and keep making return trips to go and follow up. There's so many strands of it. It could go in so many different directions. But yeah, I would hope that perhaps it's another book or a series or something. Mm. But again, I have to think about the audience and how this is going to challenge people and why people would be interested.
This idea of kind of considering how to disseminate the work, can you talk a little about how you feel about that or how you approach that?
Well, I think it's a very tough challenge because you're sort of looking into the future, and I haven't even finished producing the work yet.
Right.
But I've already been having meetings with museums and people about post-production, and I've got a lot of people who are interested in even funding that right now. While I still need another year to go and make it, which is kind of interesting, and perhaps that's something that in my practices maybe come with age or with my career or reputation or something, that people are willing to do that now.
Yeah,
so perhaps it's sort of the power of your photography also comes with you and your reputation, people seeing a little bit of what you've done and wanting to see more already. Right. So that would be really great. Mm. But again, all these things sort of need funding and need help. But I have also been, at the same time, while you're busy organising the logistics of how you're going to do this and how you're going to fund it, been looking ahead and taking that leap. I've spoken with different refugee charities. I've spoken with arts organisations in London and saying, look, can you partner me with people? If you find Somali poets, if you find some musicians or something, it would be amazing to work together. Like, I'm always trying to find new audiences. So I am putting this out there already to people.
Yeah. No, I think that's interesting because that's the work in a way, isn't it? It's like taking the pictures in a way, you could argue, is the easy bit. Or the enjoyable bit or the fulfilling bit or whatever. But the grind of like making phone calls and sending emails is the thing I think a lot of us need to get our heads around. And it seems like you're a good inspiration in that respect for the way that you do that.
I always think the toughest part of any photography project is actually putting it together at the end.
Mm.
I mean, yes, your editing is always really hard and your editing can send the project one way or another. And I always see editing as something that's fluid. Like, I make multiple edits. Like, nobody gets the same edit. No magazine or no art gallery or whoever it is going to have the same edit. You make a different edit 10 years down the line than you would have originally.
Yeah, of course.
So I never see it as something fixed. But actually putting the story together and making that narrative is actually, I feel, the hardest part to actually do. So I think once you've got that, and at least you've got it out once or twice, then it sort of tends to roll. Mm. Well, hopefully it will.
Mm. When you come back from these trips, especially where, you know, it's been traumatic or, you know, you've witnessed awful things, do you find it difficult to readjust into your normal London life?
No, I mean, I haven't lived in London. I mean, I've been back in London the last few years, but I haven't actually lived in London for quite a long time. I think the sort of shock of being back in London is always quite strange, but it's home. It's where I come from.
Mm.
You know, just getting off a plane and seeing a double-decker bus isn't strange. It's actually normal. But again, just as normal, perhaps, as where I've been travelling, I also feel I've just felt very at home, you know, living with the Yemeni women, because I'm also quite used to that too. So I feel sort of almost quite torn between. And perhaps I think the things that hit you hardest is perhaps the normalcy and the mundaneness of, you know, life in London more than anything else. But
but that's often the problem, isn't it? That, you know, normal life does seem very mundane in comparison.
But then I come back and I have a child to come back to. So that's
the key.
Incredibly happy.
Yeah.
And, you know, at the same time, I've also realised, you know, my daughter's 5 now, almost 6, that I've sort of been a nurturing mother. But I also need to be a good influence on her and somebody for her to look up to. I also want to make her proud and, you know, that she can look to her mother as doing something special too. So that's also very important to me when I think about doing the work.
Yeah.
And, you know, even now when I'm out and I'm working, I always sort of keep her very much in the front of my head, not even in the back of my head, because it's really important I work as hard as possible.
Yeah,
because I do have to get back to her and I do need to stay safe.
Yeah, of course. Oh my gosh. But you must miss her horribly when you're out on a trip. I mean, it must be really quite challenging sometimes.
Yeah, but then, I mean, I'm a single parent, so I'm on my own with her. And I had a realization sitting up with some Yemeni women recently. And one lady, Hayat, her husband and three children were both killed in an airstrike together. And she now works in the community trying to help other women who are on their own. There's a huge amount of the refugees I've met that are lone women. There's another girl I've been working with who's escaped from sexual abuse in Yemen. And somehow I feel like we still found strength in each other, that perhaps that, you know, like them, what I find that keeps me going, you know, is, again, just doing something that you feel compelled to do and trying to, you know, perhaps listening to other people's stories or doing my work or trying to do some advocacy for them or get their stories out there, you know, is something that keeps me motivated and keeps me ticking day by day, just as the same as what they were doing.
Right. But also, do you think this age-old question, in a way, that, you know, being exposed to people with such incredible stories, you know, where you've lost your whole family or your children or whatever, does that in somehow, you know, make you feel grateful when you do come back to normal life, or is that just an impossible sort of thing to bear in mind sometimes?
I don't think I ever think about it like that, because I think, I mean, there's very few people I know that haven't had loss in their life.
Mm.
Life has never been very easy to me. I've always found it a real battle. So, no, I don't think like that. And I actually just, as I said at the beginning, I just feel very, very proud and very privileged that I actually have even sat down and heard all of this, or that they've revealed or opened up their lives to me. I mean, that's an incredible position to be in. And I that's, you know, to me, almost tantamount to everything I do.
Yeah. Well, Alex, thank you. It's been fantastic to finally talk to you. We've been trying to get this organised for so long, and I'm so, so glad we finally did it. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
No, thank you.